Welcome to the brand new My Green podcast. So what's new about this? Well, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see our lovely faces, or certainly the ladies' lovely faces. I'm Jarvis Smith.
I'm Katie Hill.
And I'm Jo Wood.
Also have the wonderful Lily Cole to discuss how she got into activism and all of her recent projects.
Before we start, though, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and click the bell to turn on notifications. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook under the handle MyGreenPod. Check out our website, mygreenpod.com, where you'll find our humongous eco marketplace, which stocks everything from sustainable flip-flops to ethically sourced gin.
Yeah, the important stuff, flip-flops and gin. And this is Herbie, for anybody else that's watching. As you can see, we're full-time parents and Herbie is our boss, so he's keeping an eye on us, basically.
Gorgeous.
So welcome, Lily Cole. Thank you so much for joining the My Green podcast.
My pleasure.
If I look like I'm bouncing around, it's because I'm sitting on an exercise ball, so I'm not on a ship.
Because you are bouncing around.
Exactly.
If I look like I'm bouncing around, it's because I am bouncing around.
Brilliant. Well, look, I was looking at your website today, and I mean, it's just lovely, first of all, the way you've introduced yourself as a human being number one. but then you've said, you know, sometimes supermodel, which we probably many people know you as, an actor, a filmmaker, a writer, founder of two businesses, is that right?
Yep.
Possibly more. You can tell me more about those in a minute. And a mother. So there's quite a plethora of different ways of being there. If I were to say to you now, who is Lily Cole, what would you say?
Oh, God, even that phrasing makes me uncomfortable because I don't think of myself with two names. I just think of myself as Lily. Who am I? I think human being is the one that I feel most comfortable with of the ones you just rolled off, because I feel like all the other ones are just labels that come and change and have different associations and projections onto them. I'll take human.
No, beings. I love that. So being human is...
And a cat mother, because my cat
lovely.
On my lap.
That's a good sign. If cats pop into the recording, it's always a good sign, I feel. I'd really love to get into the activism and the sustainable campaigning work that you've clearly been drawn to do. Is there a defining moment for you that you realised, I want to use my profile for this work? Is there anything that, you know, absolutely made you want to make that decision?
I don't think it was so much like, I want to use my profile for this work. It was just that I care about particular issues. Well, I care about a lot of issues, but I cared about particular issues. And I think I would have cared about them regardless of what means I had to try and help, you know? And it just so happened that I also, because I started modeling at such a young age, had a profile. And so that became one of the tools I could use to try and participate in the things I care about, rather than it feeling like I should do it because I have a profile, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It does, absolutely. I mean, why did you want to do that? What did you feel drawn to act upon?
It's hard to narrow down, but I think a mix of things. I mean, I was brought up by a mum who's very kind of conscientious and was always sort of talking to me and my sister about things going on in the world. Mm. And then when I started modelling... I was getting approached by different charities and organizations to support different campaigns. And I was also sort of drawn into a few issues around brands I'd worked with who were in controversies. And I just couldn't not care, if that makes sense. So I always really cared. And so I was always sort of interested in either the charities' work that were approaching me and trying to understand these issues better, or conversely, if there was an issue around a brand I was supporting, I felt quite responsible to try and understand that. And in that process, I sort of started understanding things a bit more and trying to get my head around how the world worked and what are the different issues that, you know, that we're grappling with. And I'd say it was like a few years of what really felt like a bit like research in a way, doing working with different charities and NGOs and companies through my teen years, that I was sort of trying to understand what I cared most about and where I felt I could be most effective or wanting to kind of channel that energy. And I guess two things really emerged for me. One was the environmental kind of focus, because it just felt really obvious once you start looking at the environmental data and information that was already around nearly 20 years ago. It was just fairly straightforward that like guys, we just have one home, you know, like if we f this up, we're really f-ed. And like every other issue that we're dealing with, whether it's human rights or animal rights, will be made worse or exacerbated by not having a healthy environment. It felt like the sort of rug underneath everything else. So that felt quite clear. And then the other area I think that felt quite clear to me was like trying to have a more economic lens or economic focus on thinking about issues, because I didn't want to separate out the businesses that I was modeling for or working with and the kind of huge power I could see business as having. I didn't want to kind of separate that from then the philanthropy space and the desire to sort of like solve problems. And so I became increasingly interested in how do we actually try and encourage businesses to be more responsible and to solve issues in their kind of DNA rather than create issues or exacerbate issues that then the NGO sector has to kind of beg for money to try and fix. I mean, I'm simplifying it, but it felt to me that those two spaces felt more siloed than they should be, philanthropy and business. And I was kind of interested in trying to see where they were already being woven together and work in that space.
Yeah, nice. I really love that. So it's kind of a philosophical approach to your work. I mean, were there particular brands?
I like philosophy, but I think it felt quite pragmatic rather than philosophical. It was just like being quite pragmatic about it. It's like, guys, there's this like enormous machine of capitalism that's like running everything and affecting almost everyone's lives, or if not everyone's lives on this planet. Like, let's use that. You know, let's try speak that language better. It felt quite... I would say it wasn't as nice as philosophy can be. I quite like philosophy. It felt just more pragmatic.
I think what I was kind of alluding to is that there needs to be a level of awareness or consciousness in order for you to even consider that. I mean, you know, I don't know many models, but I'm guessing that, you know, when you get offered a job that's paid for, you know, you want to take that job because it's an income source. So were there particular times in your career that you said, no, absolutely not, I'm not going to work with that brand?
Yeah, quite a few over the years. And it became increasingly narrow what I could do. And I think, although interestingly, that seems to be widening out in recent years, which I think is a really
thank
good
goodness.
Sign.
Yeah.
Thank God, yeah, that the brands are waking up. So it did narrow things significantly. But I was also always interested in doing other things. So I was acting, I set up my own businesses, I started writing. So I always felt like, it was okay because I didn't see modeling as a sort of like long-term job I wanted to do. Yeah. And it just also was just like my truth. And I don't know, I couldn't not, I think you make yourself really miserable if you sort of ignore yourself. So I didn't have much choice in a way. Luckily it seems the tide is turning and now I'm actually doing a bit more kind of fashion modeling work again, because it feels like there's much more appetite in the industry for these conversations and pushing things in this direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought it was a big shift in consciousness when Love Island, you know, that classic fast fashion show, became sponsored by eBay and are now pushing secondhand eBay clothes. It's fantastic.
Oh, wow. I didn't follow that. That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very big mainstream shift. When did you start? Is there a kind of year in, you know, how long ago was that? Was it over a decade ago? Was it more recent? When did you start this environmental work?
Nearly 2 decades ago, which ages me significantly. I am 34 and I started modeling when I was 14, and I started really sort of looking at this stuff when I was like 16. So,
Wow, that's a long time. So look, here's a fun question.
Not that long.
Well, I mean, 20 years being an activist for campaigning is in the grand scheme of things.
I know, I'm joking, I'm just trying to kid myself, I'm younger, that I'm still a kid.
Well, you're still very young, I'm 51 if it makes you feel any better.
Oh yeah, that makes me feel better, thanks.
But What would you say has... Because, look, let me just... This is a bit of a loaded question. So it looks as if the IPCC report is correct, right, and the science is correct, we've got 2 years to peak emissions and then reduce emissions by 45% by 2030, right? So as far as I can see, this is absolutely critical, red alert. You know, we need to move really quickly. But what have you seen in that length and breadth of time that is a really significant, hopeful change for you and the work that you've been doing in this area?
Well, I'm going to sort of answer it by not answering it, because you're asking for hope. And I have to say, as you ask the question, I'm just feeling quite pessimistic. Because I think that it's highly unlikely that those targets are going to be met. I was just looking at a report this morning that's kind of look it has been studying what the impact will be if emissions peak at around 2040, and then hit potentially 2 degrees of warming for, they say, I think 60 years, and then decline. So this is predicated on like the idea that maybe there'll be some technology that gets invented that we're not quite aware of yet that brings emissions down. And anyway, that report is still really alarming, that even if we kind of go beyond a 1.5 degree threshold for a number of decades and then come back, there'll still be long-lasting damage to thousands of species. And I was thinking when I was reading that, like, that's interesting that they've chosen 2040 as a peak, a moment of peak, you know? That I wonder what assumptions have gone into that thinking. And that, because that's already recognizing that what the IPCC is saying, which is that we should be peaking before 2030, is not going to happen. And I think that that's fairly, unfortunately, quite realistic, it feels right now, because it feels that we're just not slowing down and curbing emissions globally at the rate that the IPCC have been asking for many years. And it almost feels as if there's a, I don't know if it's a kind of collective denial combined with a sort of maybe like callous, it's not going to affect us mentality. You know, that some people and some communities and some places and some species are more disposable than others. And so there's a sort of like level of loss that's just being factored in as like acceptable by I guess the governments of the most powerful countries in the world. I'm simplifying the narrative, but I'm trying to get my head around why and how we are basically as a species like sort of ignoring the like what the most advanced scientists globally are telling us and warning us is happening. All that to say, I think that there is a lot of action. And so I think that even a kind of prediction of a 2040 peak in emissions is somewhat hopeful, right? Because that's making the assumption that action is happening, even if it's happening slower than we want it to happen, or the scientists want it to happen. It is happening. The net zero goals have been made by many, many different countries now around the world, many different corporations. And we are seeing efforts increasingly towards decarbonization, sometimes even rewilding, you know, different kind of, yeah, I think there's a long list I could say of, and it's one of the reasons I wrote my book, Who Cares Wins, is cataloguing all the different positive trends that show that things are going in a more positive direction. So I don't know, sorry, that was a really rambling answer, but I'm sort of mixed optimism and pessimism, where it feels like, yes, there's a lot happening and there's a lot underway to give us hope, but I'm still slightly freaked out, if not very freaked out, by the fact that the pace of change doesn't seem to be matching what the science is demanding of us, and that we're not quite clear what the kind of cost of that will be, how much loss and damage is going to be, has already been, you know, kind of put underway, and how much more there is to come. It seems like a kind of crazy gamble we're making collectively.
Thank you for such an honest answer. I mean, as a mother, that just drops into deeper layers of despair, right? I mean, what if I were to ask you a very personal question, in a sense of, you know, what are you planning to do for your children? Like, how could you answer that, just as an inspiration to other parents out there listening and other people that are connected with children? What's your plan?
I mean, it's the thing that really kills me, you know, is like looking at my, I've got 7 year old, she just turned 7 this weekend. And
happy birthday, Wilde.
Thank you. No, we had the best weekend. It was so nice. But it brings me to tears very often because I'm sort of terrified by the future that she and everyone else she represents, you know, from her generation, the generations after her, and also other kids that are alive today in more vulnerable communities are already facing. Mm. And I think I sort of hoped, I started writing my book when she was just after she was born. And I think I was sort of hoping that by the time she was a teenager and more cognizant of what's happening in the world, we'd have sort of got this a bit more under control. And therefore, And I'm still hopeful. And some days I feel more hopeful than others that everything's going to be all right, you know, and we'll figure it out. We're a very smart species. We've figured out lots of things before. Mm. we'll figure this out. And then other days I feel really, really, really worried and really upset. In terms of practical steps, I have put my flat in London on the market because I want to put the money from that into rewilding and into kind of like a conservation, regeneration of land. So that feels like a very kind of pragmatic thing that I want to do in response. And obviously in my terms of our lifestyle, I just try and walk, you know, as lightly as possible whilst also being super aware of the fact that it's not light enough, you know, and very, very, very far from whatever version of perfect is possible in this modern age. So yeah, that's where I'm at. I don't have particular, like, we've got a bunker in the Orkney Islands and we're going to go there at all. But I do feel like, yeah, putting money into, if you have the ability to do that, into land and like, for me personally, turning like what has been very much theoretical, like in like a lot of my environmental work has been very theoretical of like working with companies, working with the UN now, with businesses, etc., thinking about systemic change. I'm much more drawn right now to like, how do you make that tangible and actually look after a little patch of land? You know, because if everyone did that when they're able to, we'd probably achieve a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I'm very lucky to live up at Boughton Hall Sanctuary. North Yorkshire. You know it, do you?
Roger Tempest.
Yeah. Roger and I are friends. Yeah, so I live in one of his houses. And funnily enough, my neighbour yesterday, because one of the houses next to where we live is a holiday cottage.
Yeah.
And Alistair, the CEO of Rewilding Britain, was here.
Oh, cool, nice.
Because Roger's, actually, we planted, I think, nearly 400,000 new trees here to stimulate the rewilding. So they're going for a bit of a NEP type project. But anybody interested in rewilding, I will say look for NEP Estate because they are the masters at rewilding. No, thank you for that. I actually agree. I mean, there's two things you said which are poignant. One is, you know, is there a technology? We may need a technology that needs to come into play in order for us to keep, you know, temperatures down. And of course, that's nature. That's carbon sinks. That's trees. We've already got the technology. We've just messed it up a bit and it's not functioning properly.
And you know what? Just to intercept there before your second point. That is actually one of the things that gives me the most hope, which is that when you give nature a chance to rebound, it rebounds so quickly and is the most extraordinary technology. And that's just like, that's so like, it's not like wishful thinking. That's so within our reach. Actually, how do we empower nature and give nature more space?
Yeah. How do we get out of the way?
I just read, I recommend reading it. Anyone who's listening and is interested in this topic, which I'm sure they are if they're listening to your podcast, George Monbiot's new book, Regenesis. I spoke to him about it a few weeks ago. And it's making the case that he does this video where he just sort of says, there's a really simple way we can solve this problem. We just have to stop farming animals. And it sounds really radical and obviously has had a lot of pushback for being somewhat radical. But actually, it's like that, like literally like a change that simple. If the, like, the vast majority of the world that have the choice of what they're eating made that choice, you would free up so much land. Like, I think it's something like 84% of agricultural land is for animal agriculture. You'd free up so much land overnight that you could undo like over a decade, they say 17 to 19 years worth of fossil fuel emissions could be drawn down through rewilding that land. So that's just one example, but actually it suddenly opens up this window in my mind of like, oh, there are actually a few levers here that could, within the existing realm of possibility and of existing technology, solve this problem.
Yes.
And that
yes.
makes me hopeful.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Just a little bit of background. I studied with a female shaman in England for 14 years before getting into business. And my whole training was listening to nature, ultimately, mm-hmm. through sacred practice of yoga and meditation and stuff. But and actually, you know, the more and more I tune into nature, the more and more hopeful I can feel, because the vibration of nature. I bet nature's not calling this a climate crisis. I bet nature's just calling this an evolutionary opportunity for those human beings who happen to walk on my land. But anyway, that's another story. But that brings me nicely into your book, because you did mention it, which was the second point, Who Cares Wins. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about why you did the book and what it was about? And I'll just read this out. It's chronicling 1,000 ideas which might help halt the sixth mass extinction, which is the place that we are in today. But what was the book for you? What was its purpose? And what's the impact it's had on you since?
So I started the book because I'd spent a few crazy years trying to set up a gift economy platform called Impossible that I'd really thrown like all my money, all my time, all my energy into doing. And a chapter of the book chronicles that and all the research in that space and why I still think the gift economy, which is like what indigenous, you know, kind of economics yeah. have practiced for thousands of years, is a really powerful way for us to rethink about our relationship to each other in the world. So it began actually just as that chapter was going to be the whole book. Penguin had asked me to write about that project. And then when I started doing that, I thought, why don't I make my life about 100 times harder and make this book about 100 or 1,000 different solutions? Because I'm insane like that. And instead, I pitched back to Penguin, well, why don't I expand it and make it kind of different reasons for optimism? Because I've seen in doing, kind of like environmental campaigning for so many years, I've seen a lot of trends moving in a really positive direction and a lot of amazing yeah. ideas. And wouldn't it be kind of great? And I was telling this in 2016. So when there was still very, like, I don't know how to capture it, but it wasn't the level of environmental awareness we have today. I think 2018 was a real turning point when the IPCC report came out, Extinction Rebellion, the youth climate activism, etc.
And so this Blue was just... Planet.
Yeah, this was a few years before that. And thinking like we need more optimism, because it felt like so much of the environmental messaging wasn't mainstream enough and it felt very doom and gloom. And yet I could see there were all these trends, whether it's the emergence of B corporations and stakeholder capitalism or conscious consumerism and or direct democracy through technology or the gift economy or indigenous wisdom, etc. There were all these areas I'd been looking at that I thought were really interesting. And so I pitched to write about those. And then, spent about 4 years writing the book and sort of evolving it as I was writing it, because, as I just mentioned, this whole kind of protest movement grew so exponentially in response to the 2018 IPCC report. And, of course, all the technologies have been innovating all the time. So, the book called Who Cares Wins looks at all of these different ways that give me hope, that there are lots of ideas out there, there are lots of organizations out there, there are lots of people out there, and even sometimes politicians who are trying to solve these problems. And if we give them license and we kind of support them in different ways, whether it's through buying their products, not buying their products, being influenced by their thinking, sharing their ideas, participating in some different ways, then maybe we have more chances of getting where we want to go. And the other thing I would say probably that I tried with the book to do, and I continue to do with the podcast that we developed at the back of the podcast, sorry, of the book, which is also called Who Cares Wins, is to bring together divergent perspectives, because I personally feel that this is a really collective challenge that we need an extraordinary level of collaboration to try to solve. And unfortunately, it seems like we live in an increasingly polarized society where so many issues are being politicized. Even, now, well, not now, but for a long time, even kind of environmental movement has been politicized. Mm. And I think that's really unhelpful. And so what I've been trying to do is bring together people who I think have ultimately the same end goals and similar intentions, but might have very different ideas about thinking about how we change the system or how we evolve things. And I try to offer space to the different thinkers and different ideas because that's my philosophy, that we need like collaboration and communication to find a way through, rather than anybody being like, this is the perfect way, or this is the right way, or this is the silver bullet, you know? So that's the kind of space I'm trying to navigate.
No, I love that. I love that. I mean, just, it speaks volumes of your integrity to a mission to go from a kind of a book to, you know, a whole heap of different sections of a book. So I think we all applaud you for that. Thank you. What would you say is, if there were one or two, perhaps one's going to be difficult, but if there's one or two things that you'd pull out of that book that really, really changed your, you know, outlook, what might they be? And again, it's a bit of a loaded question because I've seen some of the work that you've been doing with the Indigenous. I'm hoping you might be able to shed some light on that.
So I'll mention a couple of things. I think that the meat one I've already mentioned is a massive one.
Yeah,
I think it sort of
brilliant.
It blew my mind when I looked at the data, just how big, it may be the biggest issue we have, actually even bigger than energy in a way, to think through when it comes to, the environmental situation, let alone the kind of moral questions that one could raise. So meat for sure was almost a surprise, actually, the size of it. Feminism, so I did a chapter on gender equality and how it connects with the environment, and it was so huge as a topic, and there were so many different intersections that I felt like it could be its own book. And actually for the podcast, I've made it its own season, so the second season of the podcast is just focused on kind of different ways of thinking about how gender and kind of social issues intersect with environmentalism.
Nice.
And then, as you asked, I will definitely shout out the Indigenous wisdom piece, which came towards the end of the book, but maybe has been the part that I've tried to lean the most into since finishing the book. I've been organizing different Indigenous listening sessions in different spaces, like COP, for example, and helped a bit with one for Davos more recently. So basically, like, we have, I mean, sounds like I don't need to tell you much about it. You sound like you know a lot, but the like modern way of existing with one another is very modern, right? It's only, you know, however many centuries old, and yet we're sort of brought into it as if it's some version of normal, and as if human nature is kind of wired to be this way. But actually, for tens of thousands of years, humanity has existed in other types of forms and formations, without completely destroying their ecosystems. And we're, you know, we've decimated so many of the different Indigenous communities and animist traditions globally around the world, including even in Europe. But there are places where there are older lineages of Indigenous wisdom still alive today that actually are being fought for, often on the front lines, you know, of these different crises. You've got Indigenous activists trying to hold on to their lives and their communities and their languages. I tried to take inspiration from Indigenous communities I've met and I've been fortunate enough to spend time with, and also through reading kind of different anthropological papers, spending time with anthropologists about different ways that societies have organized themselves in the past and today. And I think for me, there's lots I could say to that, but the first thing is just remembering that this isn't the only way that humans can exist, and this isn't the only this isn't normal. You know, there isn't a version of normal, and actually, this might be quite an abnormal way of organizing society in historical terms. I think like modern society is like a blink of an eye, you know, in terms of time. I think we've been gatherer hunters for like, I can't remember the statistics, but maybe like 98% of human history or something like that. So for me, it opens up just the possibility of imagination, of different ways of being, and without wanting to sort of romanticize or generalize, but you know, there are similar themes that come up in different lineages from different places around the world that often have a much more reverential relationship to nature, that understands humans as connected to other species and interdependent with other species, rather than somehow like disconnected or even superior to, which it feels like our society wants to suggest. I did the listening session we did in Davos with a guy called Sean Wilson, who traveled from Australia for it and comes from the Cree tradition originally. He spent time with different indigenous communities around the world and been, I think, initiated into a few different communities. And so I'd asked him this question of how is there a way that you would describe a similarity between different indigenous lineages that you've spent time with and you know well? Is it possible to kind of describe a similarity between them? Because it seems to me that there are a lot of similarities, but I don't want to, like, you know, project that or romanticize or simplify. And I loved his answer, which was that in his experience, there's a different kind of ontology of being where humans are understood in relation to the rest of the world. So it's a relational ontology. So it's like just a different way of seeing reality. And the way he framed it was sort of extraordinary, because I'd interviewed the amazing physicist Carla Rovelli for my podcast not long ago. And I'd asked him, I've always been a bit geeked out on quantum physics and how, like, our version of science is really still very limited in its understanding of reality. And I'd asked Carla Rovelli to sort of like sum up how he described the latest findings of quantum physics. And he used almost identical language, that reality is relational and that everything exists in relation to everything else. And so I just thought, this is so incredible that you have like the ontology of indigenous traditions being met with the kind of latest in, you know, quote, Western scientific thinking through quantum physics, and they're arriving at similar conclusions.
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite beautiful.
Yeah, fascinating. It's like the convergence of spirituality and science.
Yeah. It just took the Western science a little bit longer.
Yes, exactly. But I was just going to say, haven't the kind of sages and those masters that we, you know, we know about, the shamans and the Indian masters and things, they kind of, you know, they talk about everything as relationship and understanding the natural science of it, or the sacred law.
I just finished a book literally last night, Jason Hickel's book, Less is More, about degrowth economics. And I mean, it's a brilliant book. I highly recommend reading it. Most of the book
Thank
is
you.
Making a kind of economic argument and looking at kind of the history of economics. But he begins and ends in more philosophical terrain and takes a lot of inspiration, I think, from indigenous thinking and wisdom. And he makes the argument that it was exactly this sort of switch in ontology that enabled capitalism to go on in the direction it's gone for the last 500 years of exploiting, you know, people and nature, and kind of driving us to this crisis point. Because it was predicated on the argument that, like, what, you know, Descartes and the kind of Enlightenment thinkers were suggesting, that mind and body were separate, and that there was something kind of special about the human mind that made humans different to other species, different to nature, different to animals, and therefore that was sort of used to justify the exploitation of nature. And in that process, animist thinking, which had existed all around the world, including in Europe, through a process, he argues, of enclosures in Europe, and then at the same time colonization globally, all of that type of indigenous and animist way of seeing a human relationship to the natural world was muted, and this other way of kind of this other ontology of seeing humans as separate and superior was sort of used to justify what we've seen happen, you know, through capitalism and colonization the last few hundred years. I hope I've done a correct summary of him. But that was how I interestingly saw him weave together this very philosophical terrain with the very tangible economic terrain to understand how we've got to this situation. Because he's sort of making the point that no systemic change is gonna work unless we can change the deeper ontology again. Which is sort of the conclusion I think I've come to, which is like, if we don't change ourselves and the way we think and the values that we hold, then everything else is going to be somewhat cosmetic.
I would absolutely agree with that. I'm often drawn to the word indigenous, because it's surely every single human being on the planet, born to this planet, is indigenous, unless you know of anybody coming from, you know, Orion or something. But I think the point of that is what we've lost, perhaps, and what you're saying is we've lost the connection with that deeply rooted way of being, because of the the system that we're born into, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we accept that to be the truth, and actually it's not. It's just a man-made situation that we're all playing out. But no, thank you for that. Just remind us again of the book. So Less Is More and the author?
Jason Hickel.
Jason Hickel, thank you, because I'm sure our listeners would definitely want to tune into that. Oh my goodness me, I mean, I could genuinely talk to you for days. So fascinating and interesting. If I were to say to you, and this is just a bit of a cheesy thing we do at the end of the podcast, if there's one thing that you do in your life that you notice not many other people are doing around sustainability, what would that be?
Ooh, good question. I'll give you the pragmatic and then I think the more meaningful one. So, the pragmatic one, and maybe loads of people are doing this, is but having just moved back to a city after 2 years in the countryside, I'm now living in Lisbon, I've been really struggling to work out how to compost in a city. Yeah. And I've managed to find, by hook or by crook, a local farm that I think I'm going to take my compost. So I think it's easier for some than others in terms of like cities and councils' rules around composting, but food waste and composting is massive. So trying to make that effort from a pragmatic perspective, I think, is a good one.
Nice.
The more powerful answer I will give, I mean powerful as in I think more important, is I think, and I don't mean to be self-congratulatory, but I think what I'm really trying to do that I don't see happen enough and I really want to see more is trying to be like radically open-minded to other people's perspectives and other people's positions, and to really interrogate these really hot topics and really difficult, challenging questions, and really try and think like honestly about each of them and listen to different perspectives in trying to think honestly about them, rather than just falling into the like what your friends on social media or what the news that you read is encouraging you to think. Because I'm really worried that there is, especially through social media, a tendency right now for a lot of important topics to be really polarized. And I think that the polarization is not actually helping anyone, because it's just driving things further and further to extremes. And so, for example, in the podcast, the last episode of my podcast on Who Cares Wins, I brought on Douglas Murray, who I don't know if you know his work, but he's considered quite like a right-wing, controversial political thinker. And so many of his positions I personally really disagree with, but I also respect that he's very smart and there are some ideas he has that I do agree with. And so I invited him on and had what I found quite a challenging conversation, but also a really powerful, important conversation, because he was challenging some of my positions and I was challenging some of his, but I felt we were both being very respectful to each other. And I'd just love to see more of that in society, because I don't think we're going to get where we want to go unless we're willing to have hard conversations and really try to keep dialogue going.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. Pat on the back for you. So tell me, is your second series of the podcast available now? Is it launched, or are you
Yeah. Who Cares Wins on Apple, Spotify, all of those things.
Brilliant. And then there's a first series and you're now in your second series, so it's easy for people to connect with that. Fantastic. Always love a podcast plug.
Podcast to podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But one last question. And there's a bit of a background to this. We've been working with Greta Thunberg's Fridays for Futures movement with MAPA, which is the most affected people in areas. So we've released a single, which is a cover version of Swedish House Mafia's Save the World, which is to raise money to get cashed so that we can pay for 300 activists to go to Climate Week in New York and to COP27 in Egypt. So the question to you is, and I'm asking everybody this, if you could save one thing on the planet, what would you save?
I thought you were going to ask me to sing a Swedish song. Phew.
Yeah, then you have to sing all the Save the World song. No, you can play it for us, though. Oh, brilliant.
I was like, oh, my God, where is this going?
I'll send you the words. Oh, I love that.
That's funny. I did a film last year and I had to learn a Swedish prayer for it, but I'm not ready for a Swedish Save the World song. Okay, so the question was, what if I could save one thing, what would it be?
Yeah.
And it's like a species, or it can be anything?
It can be whatever comes to your awareness when that question's asked. What would you save?
I mean, I would jump in front of a bus to save my daughter's life. So I think that's probably the first answer.
Okay, and the species?
Oh my gosh. I thought I got away with one answer. How do you choose? I can't choose a favorite species. That's like even worse than choosing a favorite like song, you know? There's too many good ones. Yes. And I feel like that would be speciest, you know? And actually, let's not be so like...
No, fair enough. You did answer the question because you said your daughter, so that's understandable. Lily, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. I just want to just have a reminder that we were brought together by the now late John Burton from World Land Trust, and you know, much appreciation and honour to the spirit of John for bringing us together. Thank you for that. And really enjoyed speaking with you. And I hope we can get you onto a podcast again later down the line.
Let me just throw, sorry, just one more thing, because I can't not. I absolutely adore John Burton so much. The late founder of the World Land Trust. And he's been the biggest inspiration for me on my own journey. And actually the project I mentioned to you of trying to sell my flat in London to put the money into rewilding, the first person I called was John to ask his advice on how to do that.
Amazing.
Yeah, so he's a kind of remaining inspiration for me.
Yeah, we love you, John. Wherever you are, I'm sure you're still being an amazing campaigner and changing whatever he can change from the other side. I definitely feel like we are spiritual beings having a human experience. So that's my philosophy on life. Lily, it's been amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And yeah, good luck with everything else that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
So I have to say, it was an amazing interview with Lily Cole. I genuinely could have chatted to her all day. Clearly, she is somebody that knows her stuff, really cares about the planet, has a deep concern as a parent for what's happening, and is actually out there doing something about it. So I think there's a note there for everybody that, you know, whatever you're good at, whatever your skills are, if you can use those skills to either talk about or work on the issues that we got with the climate crisis, then you'll be living your purpose. So Lily's a great example of somebody that is truly living their purpose. So thanks, Lily.
Thanks, Lily.
Well, thanks, Joan, Katie, for joining us on this episode of My Green Podcast. And huge thanks to you all, the listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to share with your friends.
And don't forget to follow us on social media for news, events and product discounts.
If you've got any questions, you can always email us at hello@mygreenpod.com. If you subscribe to our mailing list, you'll also get exclusive discounts to our giant range of sustainable products.
That's at mygreenpod.com also, and all of our handles are at mygreenpod. So have a fantastic day, everybody!
Keep it green!
Keep it green.